we're coming to the end of the Gospel of Matthew, and most of you have been with us on this journey for 2 years. It's been, I guess, what you'd call almost a leisurely walk through the Gospel of Matthew. And this is very much reaching a point of climax. Next Sunday, Lord willing, Peter Amos will be presenting the final lesson in the Gospel, focusing upon the Great Commission. And this morning, in anticipation of that, we're looking at the resurrection of Christ, which I think is, or if it isn't, ought to be, in the minds of every human being, the most memorable event in human history. We think about notable events, things that often people talk about, you know, remember when this happened, I remember where I was, what I was doing when I heard the news. And I guess in recent history, things like the assassination of John F. Kennedy, the American president, in 1963, is one of those events. Another one, perhaps, the assassination of Martin Luther King, not too much later, 1968. And I realise for some of you that this is almost ancient history. In fact, in 63, I think I'd have been 5 years old. So it wasn't something that was on my radar so much. But it's been so important in history that people have sort of referenced it repeatedly because of its significance. Similarly with the assassination of Martin Luther King. One for me, because this did happen. In fact, I remember vividly this occurrence. I don't know if you would agree with me that it's one of those earth-shattering moments, but I was a young first-year apprentice, and when the news broke, our workshop I was a sign writer, apprentice sign writer, and half of the crew were, I want to say, bohemian artists and avid Gough Whitlam supporters. And so you can imagine the wailing and gnashing of teeth that was going on with the announcement of the dismissal of Gough Whitlam and his government. For those of you aren't aware of it, the Governor General, the role of Sir John Kerr, was to be the Queen's representative in Australia, and as such he had the power to sack the Australian government, power which he exercised quite amazingly, almost scandalously, and to this day I can remember Gough Whitlam standing on the steps there, as he is on what's now the old Parliament House, saying words to the effect, "Well, may we say God save the Queen, because nobody will save the Governor General." Kerr's Kerr became a slight that came out of that period of history. Of course, Elvis, who could forget the death of Elvis Presley, though some dispute that he's still there up on Mars or the moon or somewhere. That happened in 1977. More recently, the 9/11 terrorist attack, 11th of September 2001, in the living memory of most of us here, something that truly did, for everybody, change the world as we know it. But I want to suggest to you that the resurrection of Christ is bigger than all of those things put together. That's a big statement. And I want to sort of, I guess, justify the statement this way. Back in the beginning of the Gospel of Matthew, Matthew introduced his good news about Jesus the Messiah. He spoke of an account of the genealogy of Jesus the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. And he goes on, so all the generations from Abraham to David are 14 generations, and from David to the deportation to Babylon, 14 generations, and from the deportation to Babylon to the Messiah, 14 generations. Abraham, David, the exile, the captivity, the return. And this is profound because what Matthew is claiming is that this person, Jesus the Messiah, is not just one who accomplished wonderful things, even being raised from the dead, but rather he is the climax of history. That God, beginning with his promise to Abraham, was ultimately pointing towards this person, Jesus of Nazareth. Genesis 12, the promise that God gave to Abraham, he would make of him a great nation, that he would give him the promised land, and that through his descendants, all peoples, all nations would be blessed. The flow of history from that point forward ultimately looked forward to its accomplishment in the arrival of Messiah. The promise that God made to David in 2 Samuel chapter 7, that of David's descendants, he would raise up a king that would reign forever on an everlasting throne over an everlasting kingdom. And of course, the period of the exile and the restoration of Israel, there in the midst of that, we've got Jeremiah promising that there was coming a time when God would create a new covenant with his people. Event after event after event, all pointing towards and leading up to the arrival of Messiah, in particular, his death, burial, and resurrection. Psalm 22, remember, Psalm 22 was written by David. So historically, we're thinking of about 1000 BC, about 1000 years before the event. Listen in as I pull out some snippets from Psalm 22, which Jesus, you remember, himself cited and applied to himself from the cross. My God, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from helping me from the words of my groaning? All those who see me mock at me. They make mouths at me. They shake their heads. Commit your cause to the Lord. Let him deliver. Let him rescue the one in whom he delights. They divide my clothes among themselves, and for my clothing they cast lots. To him indeed shall all who sleep in the earth bow down. Before him shall bow all who go down to the dust, and I shall live for him. Posterity will serve him. Future generations will be told about the Lord and proclaim his deliverance to a people yet unborn, saying that he has done it. Now from Isaiah, the prophet, again time-wise, about 700 years before Christ. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to the slaughter and like a sheep that before its shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth. By a perversion of justice he was taken away. Who could have imagined his future? For he was cut off from the land of the living, stricken for the transgression of my people. They made his grave with the wicked and his tomb with the rich. Although he had done no violence and there was no deceit in his mouth, yet it was the will of the Lord to crush him with pain. When you make his life an offering for sin, he shall see his offspring and shall prolong his days. Through him the will of the Lord shall prosper. Out of his anguish he shall see light. He shall find satisfaction through his knowledge. The righteous one, my servant, shall make many righteous, and he shall bear their iniquities. Therefore I will allot him a portion with the great, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he poured out himself to death and was numbered with the transgressors. Yet he bore the sin of many and made intercession for the transgressors. Abraham, David, the new covenant, the atonement. Because Jesus himself, Matthew 16, you might remember, about two-thirds of the way through his ministry, he takes that occasion when Peter acknowledged publicly that Jesus was the Christ, the Son of the living God, and Jesus recommended him for that observation, making the point that it wasn't revealed to him by human beings, but rather God had revealed it to him. From that time on, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and undergo great suffering at the hands of the elders and the chief priests and the scribes, and to be killed, and on the third day to be raised. Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, God forbid it, Lord. This must never happen to you. But he turned and said to Peter, get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me, for you are setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things. And as we've just read throughout the Old Testament scriptures, the prophets repeatedly pointing to this truth. The Messiah would come, the Messiah would suffer, the Messiah would die, but on the third day he would be raised from the dead. And here is Jesus, some probably 12 months out from the event, highlighting the reality. Even more poignant, perhaps, in Matthew chapter 20, this is literally days before the Passion Week, the days before Jesus' triumphal entry into Jerusalem, which we know began the week that led ultimately to his betrayal and his suffering and his death. While Jesus was going up to Jerusalem, he took the 12 disciples aside by themselves and said to them on the way, see, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be handed over to the chief priests and scribes, and they will condemn him to death. Then they will hand him over to the Gentiles to be mocked and flogged and crucified, and on the third day he will be raised. I don't think it's an exaggeration or an oversimplification to say that the history of Israel points explicitly, anticipates, looks forward to this very event, the resurrection of Messiah, the resurrection of Christ. And two, it's not an oversimplification to say that the same event, the resurrection of Christ, is the very foundation and basis of Christianity. That's big. That's much more important as it was, the assassination, the tragic assassination of people like JFK or Martin Luther King. Much bigger even than that event that changed the world in 2001 with the terror attacks on the Twin Towers in New York. As important as those things were, they don't come close to this event. So let's read the text, Matthew chapter 28, the first seven verses. After the Sabbath, as the first day of the week was dawning, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to see the tomb. And suddenly there was a great earthquake. For an angel of the Lord descending from heaven came and rolled back the stone and sat on it. His appearance was like lightning and his clothing white as snow. For fear of him, the guards shook and became like dead men. Then the angel said to the women, do not be afraid. I know that you are looking for Jesus who was crucified. He is not here, for he has been raised, as he said. Come, see the place where he lay. Then go quickly and tell his disciples he has been raised from the dead, and indeed he is going ahead of you to Galilee. There you will see him. This is my message for you. Now, I just want to make a side point here. I wrestled with this in presenting this lesson, whether we would deal with issues of the parallels with Mark and Luke in particular. We know they're referred to as the synoptic gospels. The synopsis is the idea of laying side by side, and so it points to the parallelism, as it were, between Matthew, Mark and Luke. And there's a great dispute among scholars as to which of those three letters, gospels, you could call them biographies, but that's not exactly correct. In fact, it's a bit misleading, because when we think in modern terms of a biography, we think of something very different to the gospel accounts. But in that sense, we could have spent a lot of time there, and I chose not to do that. I wanted to focus upon the text and the point of the text as it's presented in Matthew. But almost as an aside, I want to make this observation, this point. Here we've got an example of the difference between ancient historians and modern historians. In the ancient world, including among the Greeks of the generation of the apostles in the first century, They gave little or no regard to what we call the pluperfect. And this relates to the concept of time, the past sense of time, and the completion of the past, which is followed by subsequent events. I know that all sounds a little bit difficult. I'll read to you this definition. It denotes an action completed prior to some past point of time, specified or implied, formed in English by had and the past participle, as in he had gone by then. He was here, but he had gone by then. The Greeks rarely used that language, that concept, and that's led to a great deal of confusion. In this context, for example, it's almost certain that what Matthew was relating there is events that occurred. It's almost like a parenthesis. And again, the Greeks in the ancient world didn't have available to them those literary mechanisms that we take for granted today. But it's almost like a parenthesis where, let me read it again, after the Sabbath, as the first day of the week was dawning, Mary Magdalene and the other women went to see the tomb. Full stop. Now there is a parenthesis. Suddenly there was a great earthquake, for an angel of the Lord descending from heaven came and rolled back the stone and sat on it. His appearance was like lightning and his clothing white as snow. For fear of him, the guards shook and became like dead men. That's like, if we were thinking in terms of film, that's like a flashback. The women are on their way. Picture that scene, on their way to the tomb. We know from other contexts that their purpose was to come and finish anointing with spices for burial. What they were expecting to find, of course, was the stone rolled across the mouth of the grave and also sealed by the Roman guard, remember. And it kind of occurred to them, apparently, on their way there, how are we going to move the stone? How are we going to work that out? As it turned out, while they're on their way to the tomb, an angel of the Lord took care of that problem. While they're on their way to the tomb, the angel appears and rolls aside the stone. And the Roman guards are terrified. And I'd suggest as soon as they came to their senses, they were out of there as quickly as they possibly could. Now we switch back with the arrival of the women at the tomb. The angel said to the women, "Do not be afraid. I know that you're looking for Jesus who was crucified," etc., etc. And it brings us to this point, and I think this quotation from a historian is about as well as we can understand. The great historians of the 19th century learned to solve their problems, that is, narrating complex stories with multiple events and characters occurring in time, by keeping to a chronological order. This might surprise you, but what we take for granted today, modern history, is only a social science that's as old as maybe 200 years. We tend to assume that the way things are, the way we see things, the way we understand things, is the way it's always been. That's not so at all. Modern history as we know it is very modern. Notice the contrast. The emphasis in modern history is chronological order. When we write a modern biography, we almost always start at the beginning with the birth and maybe even a bit of background about parents and even grandparents. We start with the birth and we move chronologically through the order of the person's life. We might highlight the events that make the person worth writing about, any particular outstanding achievements, etc. And then we'll typically, if they're dead, we're going to move towards their death and perhaps write a nice eulogy about them. All in chronological order. But the ancients didn't work that way. They didn't think that way. Such a practice, following strictly chronological order, is strictly speaking impossible unless the narration is confined to one person or to one locality. Earlier chroniclers had tackled the difficulty in two ways. Sometimes they incorporated a single story, a number of actions and speeches which had a common theme, not indicating at all the time of the occurrence. Now, some of you will remember that from classes in the Prophets. where we noted, particularly with somebody like the prophet Isaiah, for example, it can almost seem like those guys had a bunch of sermons on their A4 sheets of paper and they threw the paper up in the air and then just randomly pulled them back together and sort of stapled it, and there's your book. Well, it's not quite what happened. But what is happening is this idea of theme. The prophets would tell narratives around a theme, not around chronological order. That's why in the prophet Isaiah, for example, the prophet can be talking in one moment, it would seem, about the restoration of Israel from the Babylonian captivity, and then all of a sudden he's talking about what seems to be talking about the Messiah, which we know was many hundreds of years later. For us moderns, that's a problem. What's he doing? Doesn't he understand time? Well, yes. But he's not concerned about time. He's concerned about theological themes. And the theme might be deliverance. And so that's why he's gathered those stories together. The theme might be about judgment. And so that's why he's gathered together those stories. Secondly, sometimes they jump back and forward between two or more parallel sequences of events, leaving it to the reader to understand that each item is, as it were, a flash on a cinema screen. Today, we've got a better chance than they had, say, 100 years ago or 150 years ago of understanding this, because we're familiar not only with novels, but, and especially, cinema, film. Because these are precisely the very sort of techniques in telling stories that filmmakers employ. You can tell the difference between a boring documentary that goes systematically through the story and a dramatic interpretation of a story that has all sorts of creative elements. Oftentimes a movie will start the story with a flashback where you've got almost like you've got the conclusion at the beginning of the story. And then you go back to the beginning and then work back towards that conclusion. What's that wonderful movie about the couple with the wife had Alzheimer's? Notebook is a classic example of that sort of technique. And it adds richly to the dimension, to the emotional attraction of the an impact of the story. Let me try and illustrate it this way. I've probably bored some of you to this point. Let me illustrate it this way. I hope this will simplify it. The modern approach to history, everything in nice chronological order, might be represented this way, moving through time from the left to the right. That's the modern concept. Those troubling ancient people, though, wouldn't cooperate with that. They would start with one element, followed by another element. But now they're starting to mix up the order. That doesn't fit there. That comes towards the end of the story, not towards the beginning of the story, the black dot. And that becomes confusing to us if you're only looking at it through the mind of a modern Westerner. But now they've gone off on some tangent, and they've even introduced things that we know don't even belong there. Back on task, and it looks something like that. Now, from our point of view, that's a bit of a hodgepodge, isn't it? It's very untidy, very untidy. But from their point of view, their perspective, where they're not obsessed with chronological order as we are, to them it makes not just good sense, but better sense. Because this is how and why all of the themes, which is the important stuff, when it comes to sacred literature, the sacred themes, the theological themes, which is the ultimate purpose of the writing, this highlights them beautifully. When we begin to understand that, we can understand why somebody like John, who structures his gospel around seven miracles and seven statements, you can get the seven, you can get the idea. He's not trying to write a chronological modern biography. This is highly stylized. True, it's history, but in the way he communicates it, it is theologically stylized to emphasize the purpose for which he's writing. Look at that hodgepodge. And when you take Matthew and Mark and Luke and you try and line them up, as most moderns want to do, and say, oh, they have to fit. It's kind of like we want to do this. We want to line up the two, and we expect them, if they're true, they're supposed to match. All the details are fit together. But that's not what it works with the ancient methodology. When we try and align respectfully what I'm describing as hodgepodge, you know what I mean, with hodgepodge, all of us, oh no, oh they're different, they're contradicting one another. Well, if they were moderns and they were attempting to write modern biographies, you could say to that, amen. But they were ancients and they were writing, marching to their own drum, a very different drum, if you will. So we need to bear that in mind. Back to the text of Matthew 28. They left the tomb quickly with fear and great joy and ran to tell his disciples. And suddenly Jesus met them and said, greetings. And they came to him, took hold of his feet and worshipped him. Then Jesus said to them, do not be afraid. Go and tell my brothers to go to Galilee. There they will see me. Fear and great joy. Can you begin to imagine the mixed feelings that they must have? Think about how emotionally they've been jerked around. They've been traumatized with the loss, the brutal loss of their friend, their master, the one whom they hoped was truly the Messiah. And now all those hopes were dashed. And now the confusion, meeting angels, talking about him being raised from the dead. Go to the disciples and tell them to meet with Jesus in Galilee. Can you imagine how confusing all of this is for them? The roller coaster of emotions for them? Fear. And at the same time, great joy. This is no ghost or hallucination. The resurrected Christ is a reality. Jesus again accepts worship, which might not strike us as that significant, except through the Jewish mind. For anybody other than Yahweh to accept worship is idolatry, is scandalous. And yet Jesus, through his ministry, was worshipped in response to his grace and his healing, etc. And even now, Jesus again doesn't blink an eye at accepting the worship of these women. And of course, the reference to Galilee, we're setting up for the Great Commission. Continuing in verse 11, while they were going, some of the guard went into the city and told the chief priests everything that had happened. After the priests had assembled with the elders, they devised a plan to give a large sum of money to the soldiers. So here again, the women on their way to the tomb, and then we flash across to the scene where, while they're travelling to the tomb, the angel appears and rolls back the stone. The guards are terrified. Then we switch back to the women arriving at the tomb. The guards are long gone. The angel has pointed out the resurrection of Jesus and sent them to tell the disciples. On their way, Jesus appears to them and they worship him. While that was happening, another flash. The guards, at least some of the guards, had gone back to the Jewish leaders. We've got a problem. We've got a problem. While they were going, while the women were going, some of the guard went into the city and told the chief priests everything that had happened. After the priests had assembled with the elders, they devised a plan to give a large sum of money to the soldiers, telling them, "You must say his disciples came by night and stole him away while we were asleep. If this comes to the governor's ears, we will satisfy him and keep you out of trouble." So they took the money and did as they were directed. And this story is still told among the Jews to this day. In fact, it's interesting. Justin Martyr, who was born to pagan parents in Palestine around 100 AD. So this is about, if you put the crucifixion, resurrection of Christ, say at AD 30, then about 70 years later, this fellow who became known as Justin Martyr, a leader in the early church, was born about 70 years later. He became a Christian in about AD 130, so about age 30. He published from Ephesus around AD 155 his disputation with Trypho the Jew, in which he said without fear of contradiction, "You have sent chosen and ordained men throughout all the world to proclaim that his disciples stole him by night from the tomb." My point there is simply that even 155 AD, some 125 years later, the Jews are still following the scripts. What do we do with this empty tomb issue? How do we explain it? Well, we explain it by saying that the guards said that the disciples came while they were asleep and stole the body away. That's the official line. And of course, that presupposes that the tomb was empty and therefore an explanation was required. It's important to note that. Few people today, it used to be fashionable, 100, 200, 300 years ago, people were pretty light and loose with history and the way they treated scriptures, etc. Almost assuming it was a bunch of fairy tales and so they could do what they would, make up whatever theories they want. But scholarship today is much better. There are very few scholars today who would doubt, I mean secular scholars, not just believers, very few who would doubt that the tomb was empty, that Jesus was a real historical character, that he died at the hands of Pontius Pilate, and that the tomb was indeed empty. Now, how you explain that's another matter, but almost a consensus that the tomb was empty. How you explain that's a different matter. But absolutely, the tomb was empty. So how do we explain the empty tomb? Well, many accept the claim of the Jewish establishment. The disciples stole Jesus' corpse and the resurrection is therefore a malicious hoax or at best a pious fraud. But we remind ourselves that Jesus, and not just Jesus but the Old Testament prophets before him, said he would be raised. Remember the citations from Psalm 22, David? From Isaiah 53, Isaiah, all of these indicating and anticipating that the Messiah, the suffering servant, would be raised. That's why the Jewish authorities sought a Roman guard to prevent any tampering with Jesus' body. This troublemaker predicted that on the third day he'd rise. We need to make sure that there's no hanky-panky go on. Hanky-panky's the wrong word. You know what I mean. No funny business. And so we need to set the guard, which they did. The disciples had nothing to gain, and for most, there was much to lose. I think sometimes we forget the difference between the church in the first few centuries and the church as it evolved from the time of Constantine forward. The church, up until the time of Constantine, was a marginalised, illegal religion. Certainly after the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70, when the divide between Judaism and Christianity became obvious to everybody, including the civil authorities, the Romans. To become a Christian under the best of circumstances gave no advantage whatsoever. And for much of the time, It brought only hardship and disadvantage, sometimes even costing one their life. To think that they would fabricate this story to bring misery upon themselves. Really? Really? Sane people don't suffer torture and martyrdom for what they know to be a lie. Yes, people will die for a cause they believe in. We're very painfully aware of that in our world today, with the likes of terrorism in the name of Allah, etc. But they believe their cause. The fact that they're willing to die for their belief, that doesn't prove the belief is actually true or false, right or wrong. But it does demonstrate their conviction. And what this theory says is that the disciples, who knew it was all a make-believe fraud, nonetheless were willing to die for the fraud. That's just silly. The apostles displayed impeccable character in their teaching and in their practice. Further, they did not set up any system to line their pockets. Now, we must be careful not to read what I might say is, to a degree, a justified cynicism about Christianity today. You've got the likes, as we've had in Australia and other parts of the West in particular, the whole scandals with churches and pedophilia and whatnot. But even before that, phenomenon in places like the US with the televangelist movement, etc. The whole idea of associating Christianity with just begging money, making money. That's got nothing to do with New Testament Christianity. That's a much later phenomenon, where religion was used, exploited as a means of for people's gain, people's greed. But that's not the apostles. That's not the first few centuries of the church. It makes absolutely no sense why they would lie about something like that when there was absolutely no gain in it for them. And of course, the reality, the rapid growth of the church in the first century based upon eyewitness testimony of the apostles and the other disciples claiming that Jesus was resurrected from the grave, still remains to be accounted for with this theory. Let's just move quickly and give brief consideration to other views. Jesus revived the tomb and escaped, but we can dismiss that pretty quickly. Professional executioners, the Roman guard, tested that by thrusting the spear into his side to find and prove that he was already dead and pronounced him so. The disciples went to the wrong tomb. Oh, really? I mean, Joseph, remember Joseph of Arimathea, the wealthy member of the council. This wasn't just a little plot in a cemetery that had thousands of other plots. This was a private tomb in a private garden. I don't think Joseph would have misplaced that. Joseph probably worked very hard for many years to buy that investment for himself and for his family. And certainly his buddies on the Jewish council were aware of that. And they had strong motivation to ferret out the body wherever it could be found. The disciples were hallucinating. Again, really, groups of people simply don't see the same hallucination at the same time. Besides, that offers no explanation for the empty tomb. That might try and be and explain the post-resurrection appearances of Jesus to the disciples. Oh, it wasn't real, they were just hallucinating. But that doesn't explain the empty tomb, and the empty tomb is the issue. Similarly, the idea that Jesus' resurrection was spiritual, it wasn't physical. The post-resurrection appearances were undoubtedly real and not just symbolic. You know, touch me, eat with me, etc. Jesus went to a great length to prove that it was real, that he wasn't a ghost. But again, that offers no explanation for the empty tomb. It's all a myth. Now we're moving into more familiar territory today. It's all a myth. The Gospels are fiction with little or no basis in historical reality. Well, this presupposes that the New Testament writings were created hundreds of years after the church began. That used to be a popular theory a couple hundred years ago. But it's demonstrably mistaken. It's demonstrably not true. Few scholars today would date the New Testament writings much later than the first century AD. Most of the New Testament writings, including the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark and Luke, are known to have been in circulation during the lifetime of Jesus and his apostles' contemporaries. This didn't happen 2 or 3 or 10 generations later. This stuff, these claims were being made and these claims were being circulated orally and in writing within the church during the lifetime of those who lived at the time of Jesus and the apostles. For example, Clement was a bishop, an elder of the church at Rome. Most scholars would put 1 Clement, in which he wrote to the church at Corinth, at 95 AD. So what's that? 65 years after the death, burial and resurrection of Christ, the beginning of the church. And in Clement, he quotes the Gospel of Matthew and Luke. He also quotes Romans and Hebrews. And he makes what you would call, not quotations, but allusions to about a dozen other books of what we know from the New Testament scriptures. So what does that mean? Well, it means this. By the time of the writing of 1 Clement by a leader of the church in Rome, he was familiar with those writings. And if he was familiar with those writings, others were familiar with those writings. This is not something that happened, well, as the Apostle Paul told King Agrippa, these things did not happen in a corner. There's no secrecy about this stuff. This has been advocated, championed, proclaimed to those, well, remember in Acts 2, 22, where Peter stands up and preaches the gospel. He introduces it by reminding his audience, the people there in front of him, about the wonderful works that Jesus did in their midst, and you yourselves know these things. This is not fanciful make-believe that evolved 100, 200, 300 years later. Belief in the resurrection of Christ was the belief of the church from day one. Jesus' death, burial and resurrection lay at the heart of the gospel from the beginning and is further evidenced in the original Christian rites of baptism and the Lord's Supper. Take the death, burial and resurrection out of baptism and it means nothing. Take the death, burial and resurrection out of Lord's Supper, it means nothing. And these ordinances or rites were practiced in the church from the very beginning. No mythical explanation can account for the rapid growth of the church in the first century based upon the eyewitness testimony of the apostles and other disciples, all of whom claimed that Jesus was resurrected from the grave. It cannot be true because we know that people are not resurrected from the grave. It's a scientific impossibility. And I suggest most moderns would adopt that view. I'm not even going to listen to this rubbish. Because everybody knows nobody rises from the dead. Don't waste my time with fairy tales. The tragedy of that is people don't take the time to look at the evidence. They satisfy themselves that intelligent people don't waste their times with such things. Remember, we're not talking about people being revived from death, only to die again later, like Lazarus. I mean, a modern could easily try and rationalise things like even Lazarus, the number of the centurion's servant that Jesus raised, and even in the Old Testament, you've got a number of reviving from the dead. And a modern mind can say, oh, yeah, we understand that sort of, maybe they were probably just in a coma and they came out of a coma. Or it could be, well, there's a bit of trickery. You know, we know that people in Haiti, for example, the voodoo, they induce the symptoms of death in people with some drug and then they're able to bring them back to life or maintain them as zombies, all that sort of stuff. There are rational explanations for that sort of stuff, where you're talking about a person who died, but they've been brought back to death, but they died again. But the resurrection of Christ is something different altogether. It's not that Jesus came back to life, lived for a decade or two and then died. As some, was it Barbara Thiering, I think, several decades ago, he apparently got married. I think he and Mary Magdalene got married and they went off and had children and lived in India, I think it was, and lived happily ever after. All that sort of stuff. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about a person who died, who was raised back to life, never, ever to die again. And so your modern skeptic is right to say, that just doesn't happen. That's the point. That's the point. That's the careful observer will note that people aren't resurrected from the grave. Except, this is the Christian claim, this is the claim of the apostles and that first generation of Christians who offered this testimony to their peers, and many of their peers were persuaded. One exception. The resurrection is extraordinary. It had never happened before Jesus' resurrection, and it has not happened since. But it's not just an extraordinary miracle. It's not just an impressive display of supernatural power for its own sake, nor is it just a special favour to Jesus, per se. What God is doing in resurrecting Jesus is starting something new, beginning the new world promised long ago. Remember Abraham? Remember David? The kingdom of God, as Jesus was his favourite way of describing it, the kingdom of God, where Jesus, the King, is the first fruits of many to come. That's resurrection. That's the hope. That's the bedrock claim of Christianity. Which brings us, of course, to Galilee and the Great Commission, but that's Peter's prerogative next Sunday. So, he is risen. He is risen. All of history moving towards that one point where Messiah comes, Messiah suffers, Messiah dies, but is raised. Raised from the grave, ascends to the right-hand side of the Father, where he rules. And here we are. Here we are. This we believe. This we live by.